today at Reader's Corner, we talk to Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Eli Saslow, author of Rising Out of Hatred, The Awakening of a Former White Nationalist. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to this encore edition of Reader's Corner. For his book Rising Out of Hatred, The Awakening of a Former White Nationalist, journalist Eli Saslow spent years interviewing Derek Black and others within white nationalism. Derek has grown up at its center with a father who founded Stormfront, the largest racist community on the internet, and a godfather, David Duke, notorious as a KKK Grand Wizard. By the time Derek was 19, he had become a growing voice in the movement. But while attending college, he began to question those beliefs. Charting Derek's transformation from a young evangelist in an ugly and violent movement to his current role as an outspoken critic of white nationalism, Rising Out of Hatred is a powerful story of protest, change, and friendship. Eli Saslow is a staff writer for The Washington Post and a contributor to ESPN, the magazine. He has won a Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting and a George Polk Award for national reporting, and has been a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in feature writing. His works include 10 Letters, The Stories Americans Tell Their President, and American Hunger, the Pulitzer Prize-winning Washington Post series. Eli Saslow, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Eli, it's a delight to have you, and we're just really excited about learning more about this book. This is really an incredible story. When did you first get the idea that this could be a book, that you should reach out and talk to a guy who wouldn't, on the face of it, seem like a guy willing to flip, shall we say?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think the truth is, for most of my journalism career, I'd never heard of Derek Black. My job for The Washington Post is to write about, oftentimes, acts of extremism, racism, anti-Semitism, all of which, unfortunately, are rising into the news. And so I guess it was probably 4 years ago I was sent to South Carolina to write about a racist white supremacist named Dylan Roof, who'd gone into a church in Charleston, South Carolina, a historically black church, and murdered 10 people. You know, and as I was writing about that hate crime, I learned that Dylan Roof had spent a lot of time radicalizing on this website called Stormfront. So I went onto Stormfront for the first time myself to see the kinds of things that he had been reading. And at that time, people on this massive racist message board were saying these very celebratory things about what Dylan Roof had done. But the largest thread on the message board, the thread that had thousands of comments, was about this person named Derek Black, who at that point had just defected from this movement. I'd never heard of him, and I clicked on this thread and started to read. And in that way, I began to learn a little bit about his biography as kind of like the rising prince of this racist movement who had just at that moment turned his back on them.
I guess I didn't realize that he was actually turning his back about the same time that you were approaching him.
Which I think was one of the things that piqued my interest and made me first think, this might be something worth writing about, because my own curiosity was sort of, if somebody born within this movement, if somebody so steeped in this ideology, if he can begin to recognize the flaws and change his mind, then maybe there are some answers in that or some information in that that can help other people, a much larger number of people struggling and dealing with their own inherent racism, confront some of their ideas about race too.
I must admit, I'd never heard of Stormfront before, and it's not like I want to encourage anybody to go on the website, but is this just something you could Google Stormfront, and up pops this racist community website?
Yeah, unfortunately. I mean, and Stormfront, I had heard of it, but I didn't know very much about it until beginning to research this book. But what I found out was, frankly, pretty terrifying. It's sort of like an international racist epicenter that exists on the internet. And really for 20 years, I mean, it was one of the early sites on the internet. For 20 years, Stormfront has been attracting people from, you know, I'd say probably 20 different countries a day. It's translated into 4 languages. You know, it has its own daily news feed, its own radio station, its own dating part of the website. It is a massive community for racists from around the world, a place where kind of skinheads and Klansmen and militia groups, and also, you know, people who consider themselves academic racists, as they say, all these people come together on Stormfront and sort of strategize about how to spread these ideas more and more into the mainstream.
So let's talk about Derek Black. He certainly inherited his position in the white nationalist community to some extent, given his upbringing and his lineage. Could you help us understand where he comes from, and especially the role, I guess, that his father plays in all of this?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, Derek really was steeped in this movement from birth. His father, Don Black, is one of the largest figures in the white supremacy movement in the last 50 years in the United States. Don Black had run the KKK. He at one point had gotten together with a group of white supremacists and built a militia and tried to go take over an island called Dominica in the Caribbean to try to turn it into a white utopia. Don had then been caught by the FBI in this effort and sent to federal prison, where he began to learn how to use the internet and how to do early internet coding. And that's how he built this website, Stormfront. And Derek's godfather, his father's best friend, was David Duke, who I think, one of the most notorious racist politicians of modern times. And Derek spent his childhood sort of traveling around the country with these two men and going to white supremacist conferences. Derek's parents pulled him out of public school in third grade because they thought the public schools in Florida where he lived were too diverse. They wanted him to learn about white history and white history only. So he would travel around with his family to these racist conferences. And I think the thing that made Derek very, very dangerous, frankly, and really powerful within this movement is that while he was indoctrinated with a lot of these ideas, he was also really smart and really ambitious. And he invested himself in this ideology in really disastrous ways. I mean, by the time he was 10 years old, he built his own website, an accompaniment to Stormfront that was a racist website for kids that was visited 500,000 times. And, you know, he started creating his own radio show and building out a radio network. And by the time he was a teenager, he was the person giving the keynote speeches at these conferences throughout the South and telling these audiences that he thought the way ahead was not through cross burnings or even racial slurs, but instead through trying to mainstream some of their ideas through politics. And so what Derek did, you know, the legacy that he built within this movement that I think is very much alive around us today, is he tried to almost scrub the language of white supremacy of its very real history of bloodshed and would talk about things in racially coded ways instead of in explicitly racist ways. And in that way, as a 19-year-old, he got himself elected to office in Florida.
Yeah, that's what's amazing. I mean, this is a young kid who's pulling all of this off. So let's talk about his journey, especially his journey away from white nationalism. I want to start with a question. Why would Derek Black choose the New College? Now, I have to admit, I don't know a lot about the New College. Most of it I learned from you in your book. But it doesn't strike me. I mean, I could name a number of colleges or universities, and I won't, but I could name a number where Derek Black should have gone to school. I wouldn't have thought the New College would be one of them. Was that a sign that he was already beginning to rethink, or was he going there to proselytize, or what was his reason?
It's a great question, and one that I asked Derek many times, because I struggled with the same thing. I mean, New College, it's almost like the ideological opposite of the white supremacist movement. I mean, it's a place where the students are mostly very liberal, where they value sort of diversity in all kinds, and where sort of any kind of microaggression is called out by students, much less outright racism. So, you know, but I think for Derek, as at that point a 20-year-old kid, his family did not have very much money. He had gone for 2 years to community college. He couldn't afford to go to very many schools. So he knew that he would have to go to a school that was in state. And also, he was really smart. His test scores were off the charts. So wow. He went to the cheapest and the best school that he could go to, which in Florida is this small public honors college called New College of Florida in Sarasota. And I think the other thing is that New College is a quirky school. Like it has a lot of students who are homeschooled. Derek was homeschooled. And I think the biggest thing is that it was never in the realm of Derek's thinking or anybody in his family's thinking that Derek's mind could be changed. I mean, the day that Derek left for college, somebody called into the radio show that he and his father did every day on the air, and sort of asked Derek's father, aren't you worried about Derek going to this hotbed of multiculturalism? Aren't you worried that these kids might change his mind? And Don Black laughed and said, are you kidding me? Like, Derek is the most prominent young white supremacist in the world. If you think anybody's mind is going to be changed, it's going to be these other students. So I think there was just such a sureness from all of them that that Derek was so steeped in this ideology that nothing could possibly impact.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Eli Saslow, author of Rising Out of Hatred. So he goes to New College, apparently expecting to lead what you might call a double life.
Yeah,
help us understand how he approaches his white nationalist background and activity among these students of his now who are very different.
I think Derek realized pretty quickly once he got on campus that if these students knew about his ideological beliefs and his activism in this racist space, he would be ostracized and shunned, and sort of his campus life would be made miserable. So he kind of made this this compromise with himself that he would, he would be a regular student on campus. He would begin to make friendships and sort of be a normal college freshman. But then in his free time, he would continue to be the most prominent young white supremacist around. So he would, he would wake up very early in the morning, which in college is like 10 a.m., and would walk like far away from the dorms, and would call into the daily radio show that he was still doing with his father. And he would talk about, the multicultural takeover, and he would spread these racist theories. And then he would hang up the phone, and he would walk back onto campus, and he would sort of befriend whoever walked by. Derek had never in his life believed in being interpersonally violent or even hateful. He thought, if you have somebody in front of you, you should treat them decently, even if your beliefs are that they are inferior to you. And so because of that, he started talking to all these people on campus, and some of the friends that he began to make were, the one Orthodox Jewish student on campus who was in one of Derek's classes, a Peruvian immigrant who happened to be the kid who Derek first met in the orientation group at this college. And in this way, he began for the first time to start to make some connections with the people that his ideology had always demonized. And I think that started to make a small impact on his thinking.
Well, those two people you mentioned, the Peruvian immigrant and the Orthodox Jew, help our listeners understand what they did, how they would gather, and how they really were the impetus for Derek rethinking much of his young life.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think so. What happened was Derek lived this double life on campus for about a year. And then a student at college was researching the main extremist threats to the United States for a thesis paper that he was doing, and saw on the website of the Southern Poverty Law Center in this roll call of extremists, the photo of a kid that he sat next to in math class. And this student then posted on the internet message board at the college who Derek was. And it kind of became a huge debate on this campus about what do we do? Like, how do we try to impact the thinking of this prominent white supremacist who's walking among us? And there were very different ideas for how to do that. And I think several students were effective with really different methods. I mean, the first thing that happened was Derek was sort of shunned and ostracized. There was a big movement on campus to push Derek out, to make him feel uncomfortable, to sort of give him a taste of what he'd been doing all these years. And, Derek, I think, moved away from campus because he started to feel uncomfortable, and seeing sort of this rejection in the eyes of a peer community, it made a real impact on him. And I think it also made him vulnerable, so that when some students began to make the opposite choice and decided to reach out to him and to begin trying to build relationships with him, Derek was much more likely to say yes because he was vulnerable and he had no other invitations. So the first of those invitations came from two Jewish students at this college, Matthew and Moshe, who decided that they wanted to invite Derek over for their weekly Shabbat dinner. And sort of to their surprise a little bit, Derek decided to come. And week after week, he started coming back to these dinners, and in this kind of unlikely way, started to form real friendships with some of the people on this campus, and started to hear around this table on Friday nights about their experiences. And what it had been like for them, oftentimes as people of color or as Jews or as minorities, to live in the United States in 2014, 2015. And those experiences began to make an impact on Derek and his own fable. Mm-hmm.
So tell us about the role that Allison plays in all of this. I'm not sure whether I remember whether it's proper to describe her as his girlfriend or, and I'd be interested in your take on what's happened since then. I mean, who is Allison today? Is she his girlfriend or not?
So Allison was one of the students at those weekly Shabbat dinners. She actually was Matthew's roommate. At first, when Matthew and Moshe began inviting Derek over, Allison thought that this was a bad idea. I mean, she was much more in the, let's protest him, let's make him feel uncomfortable.
Right.
But week after week, she saw Derek coming back, and, you know, he was thoughtful. He seemed to be kind and smart. Like, sometimes as the weeks went on, he would show up at these dinners with a bottle of kosher wine, and she just couldn't figure him out. Allison now is a PhD psychologist, and she's always really curious about people. And Derek just didn't make any sense to her. Like, she couldn't figure out, how is somebody who believes and says these terrible things capable of building like a diverse group of friends and being kind to them? And she just decided, almost as her personal project, I am going to try to understand like what is going on with this person. And so Allison began having these long debates with him, and at one point even decided to try to understand Derek's ideas better and where they came from. She went undercover with him to a Stormfront conference in the woods of Tennessee and heard what all of these people thought, and then went back to school and signed up for an anti-racist class and began reading tons of literature about the science of race and all of these things, and sort of went point by point through trying to refute Derek's ideas. And, you know, and after a while, the intensity of their arguments about this led to a really close friendship that eventually, deeper into Derek's transformation, started to become more of a boyfriend-girlfriend relationship. And now Derek, as he's so far on the other side, I think by disavowing this ideology and by continuing to sort of devote a lot of his energy to fighting back against it, Derek has lost pretty much every family connection in his life. He was sort of cast out into the wilderness when he made this decision. So Allison, Matthew, Moshe, Juan, all of these students who sort of had been around him in college kind of have taken it upon themselves to form a bit of a new family structure around him, because that's what he has left.
Well, I know at the end of your book, I wrote down a quote where you say, the divide between father and son may be unbridgeable. And you're telling us that, in fact, as of 2019, there is no bridge.
Yeah, I mean, there's not much of a bridge. And I think, honestly, it's what's been very difficult for Derek is he's become increasingly public. There are real risks to him for that. I mean, there's, first of all, being seen as a traitor by a group of neo-Nazis and skinheads and Klansmen is a dangerous thing to just your personal safety. But also, I think like his family feels that every time Derek, you know, writes an op-ed about the dangers of white supremacy for the New York Times, or, you know, if he and I were on TV together talking about the book, we would walk off and Derek already would have a string of text messages from, you know, people close to him, or people in his family, people who had been close to him, who would be saying to him, you know, you're an anti-white activist, why are you doing this to us? I think it's the more public Derek becomes, like, the more it increases the tension with his family. But I think Derek also feels like, right now the stakes are too high to be silent. You know, it's I think issues of race and anti-Semitism in our country have, if anything, continued to increase since Derek disavowed this ideology. And I think he feels like even at some risk of safety and even at the expense of these tenuous relationships with people from his childhood, he needs to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, in case anybody is wondering just how deeply Don Black believed when Trump equated the white nationalists with the anti-racist, I think you point out in the book, he called it the high point of his life.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think, I think Don Black and also other white supremacists feel like they have a greater platform than they did before. And unfortunately, the data right now backs that up, whether it's the threefold increase in hate crimes as reported by the FBI or currently a doubling on college campuses in the last 2 years in terms of incidences of racist graffiti or Nazi insignia. These these white supremacists right now, and I had to spend time with them and hear from them for this book, they feel like they're winning, which is a really terrifying thing, I think, for the country.
I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Eli Saslow, author of Rising Out of Hatred. In the book, Saslow tells the story of Derek Blake, a once prominent white supremacist who later became an outspoken critic of the racist movement he helped foster. Let's talk about your spending time with them, because that's one of the things that struck me about your book is the kind of detail you knew about Don Black and his family's life. I mean, you must have spent a lot of time talking to Don Black, I assume. And
what was
that like? And how did he come away from those interviews? Did he know where you were going with this book? Did he try to argue with you? What was going on there?
Yeah, great questions. I think for me, it was Don Black always was, he decided early on that he was going to participate. And I think part of that was because he knew I was going to be talking and spending a ton of time with Derek and all of these other people. And I think part of him thought we might as well at least give him our side. But I think honestly, the other thing that compelled Don to continue to spend so much time with me is because he misses Derek. Like he's for all of Don's life, and Don has done irredeemable, awful things and deserves and frankly asks for no redemption whatsoever because he still believes all of these terrible, awful things and he's still doing them now. But at the same time, he also is a father who really loves his kid and who experienced Derek's defection almost like a death. And that because that bridge between them doesn't really exist anymore, in some ways, talking to me about Derek day after day at these long lunches that we would have, I think that almost reconnected Don back to his child in a way that he's not connected to him anymore. And so, I think in some ways Don enjoyed it, I think the other thing that I've been surprised by, because I would say for every reader that I've talked to, the book lays bare the fact that Don has acted as a monster for most of his life. But for Don, those things that make him a monster to all of us, those are just the facts of his life. Like these are the things that he thinks. He is not ashamed of trying to take over a country and turn it into a white utopia. He's not ashamed of believing that people of color are inferior. So I think he reads the book as factual. Like, yes, these are the things that I think. And that's a really scary fact. But even scarier to me is the fact that it's not just Don or these white supremacists who believe these things. I mean, the sort of inherent racism that is so much a part of America is alive and well. And I was shocked again and again to sort of see these polls as I was writing the book that show consistently that about a third of white people in America believe that they experience more discrimination and more prejudice than people of color or Jews, which is wildly, wildly inaccurate. But the fact that that much false white grievance continues to exist in the country, it gives these racist ideas real room to spread.
Was there some special moment when Derek actually broke from white nationalism, a Publix moment? I know he wrote two New York Times op-ed pieces that I learned from your book. And in those, he took on Trump in at least one of them. Was there a moment when he let his family know and when it was all public, or did it just kind of come out gradually over time?
No, there was a moment. I mean, so right after Derek graduated from college, at that point, his mind had basically changed about everything. He believed that white nationalism was not only factually wrong, but also that it was causing huge damage in the world. But he had not said anything publicly yet, in part because he knew that once he did, it might be the last time that he ever saw his family again. So, the weekend after he graduated from college, he went home to his parents' house to sort of help them fix up some windows and things like that, planning to tell them something. But he just couldn't quite get up the courage to do it. And throughout the day, the Trayvon Martin case was going on, and he heard his dad saying these awful things about Trayvon Martin and awful things about race in the country. And Derek just started to feel sicker and sicker as the day went on. I think not only because he was horrified to hear his father saying these things, but because he knew they were the same talking points that he'd been spreading for most of his life. So Derek then left his parents' house, went to a bar nearby, and finished this letter that he'd been writing to the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is kind of like the largest anti-racist nonprofit in the country. And Derek wrote a 3 or 4 page evisceration of the white nationalist ideology and sent it from that bar near his parents' house to the Southern Poverty Law Center, who then published it for everybody to see. And his family at first couldn't process it. I mean, they thought Derek's email had been hacked, or they thought that it was some kind of elaborate prank, or they thought he'd been brainwashed, or that he'd had some sort of temporary stroke. It took them a while, and I would say days of tearful, long phone calls with Derek to figure out that, yes, this was what he actually believed.
So what is Derek doing today? I thought I read in your book that he may be at the University of Chicago in graduate school or something.
Yeah, he's in the last year of his PhD program, but also he's, in part because he feels like it's his responsibility, he's devoting a lot of his time to sort of pushing back against this movement and therefore his family. So for him, that's meant a bunch of different things. Like, one of them is, as a PhD historian, he's a medievalist, and medievalists oftentimes have prioritized sort of white European history. And Derek went to college to study the same thing, thinking that was kind of the mythology that white nationalism was built on. But in fact, he's found out that the Islamic world was far ahead of the European world for much of that time. And so Derek now has learned Arabic and is focusing on the rise of Baghdad and the Islamic world during the Middle Ages, and is trying to sort of get medievalists to tell a more global version of world history. He's also spent time working with Facebook as an expert consultant, trying to help them deal with the rise of extremism and racist ideas online. And he's doing a good bit of writing and speaking about the danger of these ideas.
I hate to ask this question, but does he need any protection, or is he on his own these days?
I mean, I think he does sometimes. I think Derek is a little, not dismissive of it, but I think he just is maybe sometimes a little cavalier about it. And I suggest that he can and should do more. But if he's doing something on TV or in a big public space, there usually is somebody watching out for him, which I think is necessary. It's the people on Stormfront. One of the great things about being done with the book is that I never have to go on the website again. But I've been told that on Stormfront, people continue to see Derek as a traitor to their cause and in some ways a target. So I know he's cognizant of that.
At the end of your book, I think it is, you said something about the details of his transformation may point a way forward. What's the way forward? And I know this is your beat, but still in all, you can't help but be transformed a bit yourself as the guy who lived this.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, the lesson was, or one of the things that I think that I'm not so good at, is there are racist ideas all around us all the time. And for me, in my own extended family, and sometimes it feels easier to do nothing than it does to sort of say to a relative, to a friend, to a second cousin, to whoever, hey, I think actually the way that you're talking about the border, or the way that you're talking about immigrants who come into the country, or the way that you're talking about Islamic immigration, those are problematic ideas and they're racist ideas, and here's the reason why. And that's a hard and a scary thing to do. But I think the lesson that I took from that new college community is all of those students made the choice to invest themselves, even when it wasn't going to be easy. Nobody at that college threw up their hands and said, I think the thing that we should do is nothing. They had very different ideas about what to do, but through protest, through resistance, through outreach and through conversation, it's like a combination of confrontation and invitation. These students made a tremendous difference in terms of changing the leader of this movement. So, I guess it gives me some measure of hope that if the future heir to the white nationalist movement can wind up so far on the other side, it makes me think that it's our responsibility to try to get other people who have, more insidious, subtle racist ideas to confront those ideas too.
Well, what a perfect conclusion to a great conversation, Eli, and a great book about a terrible subject, I guess is the best way we can say it. But you've really done remarkable work here. And I think that last recommendation to all of us that, call it out every now and then. Don't just sit there and let somebody go on and on, especially if it's somebody you love or somebody in your family. You ought to be able to at least have a conversation about it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Because especially if it's somebody that you care about and right. might care about you, if we can't do the work of changing their mind, then who can?
That's right. Eli Saslow, thank you for being with us today on Reader's Corner. Again, the name of the book, Rising Out of Hatred, The Awakening of a Former White Nationalist. Thanks again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Eli Saslow. Next week, local author Alan Minskoff joins us to talk about his charming book, The Idaho Traveler, exploring the often forgotten treasures of small-town Idaho. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.